Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. We are going to have on with us this morning our special guest, Veronique Aitcha. It's very difficult pronouncing some of these Netherlands names, but she is the head of the Social Impact Rescaled, and who recently returned from visiting the open and innovative prisons in Finland. Social Impact Recall is a unique and successful approach to rehabilitation and release. It is a detention house. It is small, but yet they have high-risk cases of larger facilities. And I'm going to let Veronique speak on her own about this program she has. I want everyone to know that there are ways of having successful approaches to rehabilitating the incarcerated individuals and sometimes replacing prisons with these type of programs in housing. So I want to introduce once again Veronique Aitcha. And Veronique, if you can say your name so I can be able to pronounce it correctly, because I don't want to mess up with that name. And I thank you so much for being on with us.
Thank you so much. My name is Veronique Aitcha. You pronounce it perfectly.
Thank you. Can you tell the audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to establish such a unique detention center or detention housing? Can you explain to the audience and myself more on what brought you to this point where you did this and it has been successful?
So I work for Rescaled, which is a European movement, and we are based in several countries. We are also based in the Netherlands, and the national office of Rescaled in the Netherlands is called Restorative Justice Netherlands. So I work for both. In the Netherlands, we work on a lobby to try to have small-scale forms of detention to replace large prisons in the future in the Netherlands, but also on a European scale. So my task for the European Office for Rescaled is to find really good partners all over Europe that are already working on the topic of small-scale forms of detention, sometimes for decades already, and to really make that connections between people and between organizations so it can become a movement and hopefully in the future more the dominant paradigm when we think of the criminal justice system. Now, when we think of punishment or the criminal justice system, we easily associate it with prisons. And as a Rescaled movement, we hope it will become the future that we associate the criminal justice system much more with detention houses, with restorative justice forms. So very much the things that we see as alternatives today will be replacements in the future.
I think that your program is so unique, and I started a petition about a year and a half ago to replace prisons with long-term residential facilities, because I don't see where prisons are rehabilitating or helping anyone, especially in our country. We have an epidemic of mental illnesses and addictions, and these type of programs are more appropriate than incarceration actually in a prison setting. Mm-hmm. So if you can, I don't know if you've ever been in any of the prisons in the United States, but I understand that you recently returned from visiting prisons in Finland.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about their approaches to rehabilitation and if there's any other approaches or strategies used like the one that you yourself have started.
Very understandable question, and I think that's what we all are looking for, like what's the answer to change. And I just visited the open prison in Finland, and I visited prisons all over Europe, also in Turkey, in Albania, North Macedonia, Italy, you name it. In Europe, I've seen a lot of prisons. I haven't been to a prison in the US, however, I have friends working in the criminal justice reform sector in the US, and of course I hear things and I read things about the US, and I think one of the biggest differences I always believe between Europe and in US is that I think in Europe we have much more of thinking of social democracy, that the healthcare system and social policy is very much linked to our criminal justice system. So a very broad understanding of you cannot change the prison system or the criminal justice system without looking into healthcare policy, housing policy. And I know there are a lot of interesting people working on this topic in the US, but I think politicians are looking more into easy answers, trying to have quick answers. For example, trying to build a new prison that is much more restorative or rehabilitative, but it's not about that. It's about changing your social policy, and that's exactly what the Scandinavian countries have done in the past decades. So their prison population reduced, but not only because they changed the way they looked at a prison and that it should be more a rehabilitative environment, but also changing social policy, making sure that there were better treatment for people that have an addiction, better health, mental health care policies. So I think that's the biggest difference between Finland, for example, and the U.S.
We have, as you mentioned, we do have advocates working on trying to work on the mental health issues. We have Donna Wynant. She is a founder of Families and Friends for of Individuals with Mental Illnesses. And she's been trying to get the Department of Mental Health involved. She's been trying to get the hospitals involved in going into the prisons and doing independent provisions of medical and psychological treatment. Because our prisons, they have, I don't know if it's like this with the prisons in your country, but they have contracted providers. And the Department of Corrections usually wants the cheapest. So the contracted providers that they have are not experienced, or they're not as educated in that area as they should be for the type of surgery and treatment that they're providing. And many prisoners have been permanently damaged physically and psychologically as a result. Now, your program, is it connected with the prison system in any way, or is it an independent for those who are coming out or those who are soon to come out? Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think Reskilled facilitates the movement. So we ourselves, we don't have detention houses. We don't own them. We don't run them. However, people in the movement do. So, for example, the national office in Germany, they run a small-scale form of detention for youngsters. But it's not like a prison, or it's more an open facility where they provide schooling, but it is a replacement for prison sentences. So if that location wasn't there, they would have been placed in prison. And the same, well, we have partners like in Scotland where they have prisons for women, where there's much more an understanding that it's not about bringing healthcare into large-scale prisons, it's about changing that context where we not only, like, we don't see it as a punishment, but we see it more as treatment. And yes, some people have transgressed in behavior and therefore can maybe not be placed together with other people, but often they can. So I think we as a movement, our focus is much more is focusing on changing the system rather than improving the system. So my personal journey was also very much trying to improve education in prison, access to digital education, and really much the focus on reintegration, whereas now I don't use the word reintegration anymore, because if you have a detention house, you keep people in society, they stay part of society, therefore reintegration shouldn't be necessary in that case anymore. And I think that's often what I see with people. They either work and focus on reforming or trying to improve the prison system, trying to help individuals in these large-scale prison. And personally, I don't do that anymore, because it's only modernizing this prison system and making sure you enable the prison system to live longer for another 20 years because you provided digital education or you provided better healthcare services in prison. But actually, the prison system, the prison building, the prison culture is not healthy for anyone. So our focus is very much on making it small scale and then working together with services from the community, which can be educational centers, healthcare centers, anything that each of us uses in the community as well.
Now, I was looking at your website, a detention house, and it explained that the incarcerated or those who have participated in your program, that they're small except in cases of high risk cases. And they are people, the smaller ones, they are able to live in a communal life. And what about the high risk? Now, you have larger housing for them. And how do you work with those in the higher risk area?
Yeah, and they are all small. But the only thing is, if there's a high risk, they are still small, but they're not necessarily open in that case.
Oh, okay.
So we're trying to get away from the low and high risk security paradigm and using more terminology like becoming more autonomous in your life and agency. And I think that's the future for us when we are building detention houses. We want to differentiate much more and much better and effective between people. And some people are there because they really commit serious crimes, but that's a very low number. Other people commit crimes because they need the money. Other people because they have an addiction, peer pressure. There are so many different reasons why people enter the criminal justice system. And I have to say, I think discrimination and racism and poverty are still very strong streams or reasons why people end up in the criminal justice system as well. So I think we need to filter all of these different reasons and provide a much more effective answer on how you then treat people or how you deal with people, not in prisons anymore, but in small-scale forms. But it can also a small-scale form, for example, a housing first movement where people are placed in a house and you can have electronic monitoring, for example. So much more individualized answers.
You know, I admire, and I say this all the time, I have had quite a few of the advocates from the Netherlands, from overseas on the show. And I have to again admire the work that all of you do, the attitudes that you have, the success rates, the recidivism rates, the rehabilitation. And you just spoke about the issues that go on in the United States, which I've heard from other people in other countries as well, with the problems that we have in this country and the reason for mass incarceration. And the thing is, with your program, and the reason I like especially the detention houses, as you mentioned, they pretty much replace the prisons, and the approaches, the personal approaches that you mentioned on the website is actually it says because detention houses are much smaller and less bureaucratically organized than prisons, staff and people in detention develop better relations. And when I listen to even Franz, when I listen to Franz talk about his 27 years as a warden and how he interacted and how his staff interacted with the incarcerated individuals, it was more humane. In this country, they go by numbers, or they go by, they're being called animals. People are stereotyping. There's such a cold atmosphere in the realm of all of these issues and all of these names that they have, the treatment and everything. And this program that you have, the detention house, it is, I don't know why this has not been developed in other countries as well, including in the United States.
We see that in the Netherlands, we still have prisons, and actually we're now planning to build a new prison in the south of the Netherlands. So I think that there's always this movement of building prisons, large-scale prisons, and then you always have these counter movements. And I think we're just working towards a tipping point. And I think even in the U.S. there are beautiful examples, and I think they're more called like halfway houses or recreation houses or community centers where people go to. So it's we have the examples. It's just we need to change the paradigm that actually we can also send people to these places and where we can also have maybe a level of deprivation of liberty, but not the full body or not the complete mind. And I think that's what we still do with the prison system. So I see good developments in each country, and I see very dangerous developments from my perspective then in each country, even in the Netherlands. And I think it's just about connecting the dots. And I'm often jealous about the discourse you have in the U.S. about the criminal justice system. I think that's much more advanced than we in the Netherlands. I think we're more practical. So we see a problem and we solve it in a way. And I think understanding comes maybe decades later. Whereas in the U.S., I think you have a very clear understanding of what is wrong, and you can frame it beautifully. Not only you, but like the whole discourse from the criminal justice activists is amazing. And at the same time, it's the reality is very bad in the U.S. So I'm often puzzled about this.
Well, we know what the problems are. It's just that and so many people are talking about it, and many are working on it, right? Recently, even there's several legislative members, several politicians that recently came, they are filing these bills to actually reform the criminal justice system. However, the problem is when something positive starts to happen and people in the communities, they get upset. They don't want to see people released from prison. Then sometimes, a lot of times, these politicians, these legislative members, they slide back. They don't fulfill the full obligation that they start out to. We have the problem in the United States. It's just that we don't have the solutions are not occurring fast enough, because there's always some resistance on this other side. And that's where we have the problem. In your country, you do it. Whatever you see needs to be done, you do it. In this country, when they start out to do something and there's some kind of conflict or some kind of controversy over it or some kind of resistance over it from people in society, then they want to please both, but they can't please both, so they more or less back away from what they know is right. But what you were talking about is the halfway houses and transitional housing, things that we have here in the United States. This is for people who come out of prison. And many of them, they're not, like I noticed in your detention house, you have the facility in your detention house, you have the housing for even high risk cases. But as you mentioned, they just don't have that opening as the lower risk. In this country, they don't let anybody out that that is at any kind of risk at all. And even if it's a halfway house, they don't do it. With your detention program, you're pretty much taking over the role of the prison, but you're doing it in a more humane, much more humane approach.
Hmm.
And this is what's so admirable and so unique about your detention house, your program. And I'd like to ask you how you came about establishing such a unique program or housing.
Yeah, it came about I think 14 years ago when in Belgium there was a director of a prison, and he heard that a new prison would be built in Belgium, and it would be for 1,000 people. And he's still a director of a prison, Hans Klaus, and he thought, why are we building this prison? Why aren't we building 100 houses for 10 people? Because every time we build these huge prisons, we don't know what to do with it when we close them. They often stay empty for a long time, or they're very difficult to adapt to a different situation or a different context or a different population. So also when you look at sustainability, it would be much make more sense to have it in a community. But he started to work together with researchers and look into what if we would do that, what would be the principles. And then they at the end with a group of a lot of people worked on a little book, and then he came with three principles, which is small scale, differentiation, and community integration. So these are still the three pillars that we continue to advocate for. And you cannot do one. You cannot have a small scale detention house which is not in the community and where you don't differentiate between people. At the same time, you cannot have a large prison and try to have it embedded in the community. So we always say it's really these three that should go hand in hand. But it started out there, and I always credit him, and I think also Reskilled, for making it a movement. And because really the concept of small-scale detention houses has been around for decades and longer. In Norway, they have a lot of small-scale prisons which function exactly like we hope that detention houses all would function. So we're not trying to implement a new model. And what's happened with the prison system, that it became an export model. And I think that's very dangerous. And that's why we said we only want to focus on advocacy in Europe and not expanding it outside of Europe, also because of our colonial history. So we really want to focus and work together with the European countries and grow from and see from there what grows out of it. But it really became a movement. And now we're not trying, when we work together with organizations or countries, we're not trying to tell them this is the detention house you need to build, and here's the book, and just do what is in the book. And if you do it differently, it's wrong. We're not doing that at all. We're really trying to identify all these different type of small-scale detention houses, small-scale prisons, halfway houses that could be used as a detention house to replace prisons. So, and now we are almost in 14 countries in Europe. Next year we will have a conference in Brussels together with the Ministry of Justice of Belgium, because they will be the president of the European Union. So it will be a huge momentum at that stage to really start thinking about, what do we want in the future? Do we still want and need prisons, or is it time to really change the system?
I will say I've heard of Hans Klaus. I've heard of him. It might have been through Mariam Jacob, psychosocial therapist from the Netherlands. But I've heard of him, and I've heard of the good work that he's done as well. I will say that there have been people from the United States who have gone over to Norway, because Norway is the role model for prisons throughout the world. And there have been people from this country, I believe legislative members, politicians as well, and have gone over to Norway to learn more about their approaches, their technique. And so far, I understand in North Dakota, and I think in Pennsylvania as well, I understand that they have started to use some of these approaches, the Scandinavian approach in Pennsylvania. And so something that is going on over in Europe is actually starting to take effect, slow but sure, in the United States. And I want to, we have a caller, so I'd like to ask 602, do you want to state your name, please?
Hey, good morning. How y'all doing? This is Brother Hess.
Hi, Brother Hess. I don't know if you've been listening in, but to what we've been talking about as far as the approaches that are being taken over in Europe for incarcerated individuals. But we have on a guest with us. Her name is Veronique, and she is the head of the Social Impact Rescaled. And she can explain it better than I. Veronique, briefly, just explain what we've been talking about, the program that you have in Rescaled.
Very briefly about small-scale detention houses to replace large-scale prisons, and whereas a detention house would be small-scale, either 6 people or 15, focused on the individual and most important as well, embedded in the community.
So this is it's more like a, it's almost like a halfway house, but it's more intense, more extensive in the treatment. I wanted to also ask about the programs that these individuals that are at this house, this detention house, what are some of the programs that they get involved in, and how are they helped in that area?
Yeah, it's interesting how you say it, that it's more intense. I think that it doesn't need to be more intense. It can be more intense depending on the needs of the person. I think the most important thing is that now it's a policy change. Now, for example, judges send people to prison, whereas you can make it possible that judges send people to detention houses with or without electronic monitoring, for example. So it's a different way of punishing people or a different way of treating people. People could also, in the U.S., I know Ava DuVernay has created this beautiful documentary, 13th, where she really shows that the increase of prison population is not due to, oh, we have more dangerous people, but it's actually due to racist policies in the U.S., three strikes, you're out policies. So I think what we're doing is also making people aware that who are we actually sending to prison? And I'm always saying that the out of the 100% of people that are in prison today, I do not want that 100% to go to detention houses. I think a lot of the people shouldn't be in prison anyway. So, but once it is needed, it really depends. I think in general, like women often have a high need for, like they have trauma in their past. So with them, you can work together in the facility, but you can either, if it's small scale, you can have the care that they had already before they entered the detention house. You can continue that care within that community with the same individuals. But it really, it's based on the individual again. Some might need a therapist, others don't.
Well, I'll tell you, there's and when you mention women with the traumatic past, there are also men, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people incarcerated who have post-traumatic stress syndrome, but yet they're diagnosed with antisocial behavior. To put the fear in the public's eye, I believe, because too many people in prisons are, and I will say women, you mentioned women, in Lowell Prison in Florida, women were being raped by the prison guards. Mm-hmm. They were being raped by the staff. There was a big thing about it, and there was a big investigation going on. But to get back to those that are incarcerated, a lot of them are being, a lot of people incarcerated. We have 2.3 million people incarcerated in the United States, prisons and jails. And out of those, we have a lot of wrongful convictions. We have a lot of first-time offenders. We have a lot of victims who became offenders.
Yeah.
Again, there's a lot of prisoners who were violated as children, who grew up in domestic violence backgrounds, who grew up in the cities and the slums and the drug-infested areas, those who have mental illnesses, those who have addictions, and yet members of society in the United States, they don't look at all of these issues. They look at prisoners being behind bars, and as you mentioned, racial issues too. We have a serious issue in the United States of racism, and that is another thing. I will say there are people incarcerated now of color, but if you go on the inmate locator and you look them up, you're going to notice when it comes to the race that they're listed as unknown. Now, there's nothing unknown about a person of color. They're either black, brown, red, beige, or whatever. But even if they were classified their own nationality, but they have unknown, and that is to throw people off. So when the statistics are done, no one knows the real statistics on those that are incarcerated, the number of the percentage of blacks and browns, the percentage of Native Indians, the percentage of Arabs or Jewish. There's no way that they can tell when they don't list their races. And this just started within the last 10 years, I think, because at one time they did put down their race. But these are some of the issues. In the prisons, they are misdiagnosed. And another thing is that was told and talked about in so many cases are these large corporations that are benefiting off of mass incarceration. They have prisoners that they do allow to work for less than a dollar a day, and they're selling sneakers and shoes that they sell in stores for hundreds of dollars a pair. So they're getting cheap labor. So these are a lot of the issues that go on in the United States. Unfortunately, we also have a serious, serious rate of suicides in the American prisons, whether they're actual suicides or alleged to be suicides, because there's a lot of mysterious deaths that go on in the prisons as well. People, they listen to one-sided stories from the media. The media needs to go in to the prisons nationwide, and they need to meet with the prisoners, and they need to do unannounced visits, because when the people in prisons, the officials know somebody's coming in, they clean up their act. And prisoners around the country have talked about these things. So I just wanted to bring some of these things up because the United States may be painted as a pretty picture, but the United States has a lot of deaths in prisons. They have a lot of people committing suicides because they can't cope. They force people to double cell. And there's a lot of people who cannot double cell because of their childhood traumas, because of things that have happened to them. But yet they force these people to double cell. And there was a woman on Facebook one day, and I really got upset because I felt she should have done more. She said her son was placed in a cell with this other prisoner. And when he was placed in that cell, the prisoner jumped up on the top of the bunk, got in the corner and started shivering and shaking. We all know he may have a mental illness, as that mother said, but at the same time, there was more to that mental illness. We all know what must have happened to that young man. And yet prison guards disappear when the prisoners are needing them most. They disappear. You wonder if they're setting these people up, if they're enjoying their watching these people suffer. I don't know. But this is why I admire people from other countries to come on the show and talk about real humane treatment and conditions, because it doesn't always happen in the United States of America as the people in society may think. And the people in society are just as wrong because they don't even try to find out. They don't try to help. They want to do something that's going to make them look good, not the Most High, but them. And we need people that can actually try to make a difference, like you and your organization and others in other countries are doing. We're hearing about the success rates there. We're hearing nothing about success rates here in the United States.
Hmm.
And if you'd like to expand on that, if Brother Hess wants to say something, but feel free to respond to that.
Yep. Do you want to, Brother Hess, do you want to respond?
Well, what? You know what I mean? I don't really know how to respond to that. That's a lot. But I will say that in the end to the show thus far, I was very much so delighted, sister, for bringing this sister on. You know, Sister Veronica sounds like she has a very unique opportunity to sit where she's sitting at in Europe and kind of like have the pickings of different nations and nationalities and cultures all around her. Is kind of like being an anthropologist in a way to actually be able to go in and be able to, you know, captivate on the opportunity, capitalize. And I just listening, man, to both of you, you know, it just touched my heart because, you know, as you know, Big Sister, I've been incarcerated 26 years of my life, and I'm not even 44 years old yet, so you do the math. And it's like being at the worst, the considered worst prison, the most deadliest, murderous, suicidal prison in Southeast America for the last 6 years, you know, it has definitely given me a front row seat to analyze, assess, observe, you know, even test sometimes what is it that's, you know, the cause and the effect of certain things. You know, after studying Sigmund Freud, Carl Jung, studying Viktor Frankl and the logotherapy, studying, you know, all these different reality therapies by William Glasser, MD, and other psychiatrists, psychologists, and psychoanalysis, it's like you begin to now realize that this system is non-empathetic. And that's what's being created, a system that is refusing to empathize and place themselves within the shoes of those who have been hurt, harmed, or endangered. It's like, hey, we are going to crucify the act, not aid and assist the actor. And by doing such, you remove the empathy, you remove the sympathy, you remove the ability to do like what William Glasser says inside of his reality therapy books, which is make the connection. If you want to help someone, whether it's a child, an elderly person, a person who's addicted to drugs, you go into the AA, NA groups, the Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, they all tell you the same thing. You have to form a bond altruistically based on how you can be valuable person's life while looking for nothing in return.
Can I ask you how long you've been incarcerated, Brother Hess?
Yes, I was first incarcerated at the age of 16 years old, tried as an adult for a crime that I did not commit, and was basically forced to take what they call a nolo plea. Yes, that's what we call a blind plea. You just say that if you're not going to snitch on your family, if you're not going to snitch on your friend, you just take a blind plea, place your hands in the hands of the judge, and the judge is going to look over everything and just decide a good bargain for you. And so I was given 20 years to serve 8 straight up to max out, no opportunity for parole, no possibility of a halfway house. And I basically came in at 16, learned how to fight, learned how to survive in the worst prisons in the state of Georgia. And by the time I turned 17, I was took to the worst county jail in the state of Georgia. And by the time I was 18 going on 19, I was placed in the worst prisons in the state of Georgia. And so it was like a rippling effect to the point where I'm locked up for something I didn't do. So now I hate the system. I hate the judges. I hate the police officers. I hate the guards. because they put me in a situation where if I did not snitch, then I would be penalized to the same degree as the one who committed the crime. And so that led into an urban cultural dynamic that made it where, okay, now I have to max out this whole 8 years. So no matter what class I get, no matter if I get my GED, no matter if I come in here and act real nice and good and begin to learn appropriate life skills, it doesn't matter. You're still going to do the entire 8 years along with what you did at the age of 16 that does not count according to your sentence. And so it was a anger built inside of me. It was a hurt. It was a feeling of being neglected, abused, and discarded by the family that I love, the community that I love, but more so a system that said it actually has a constitution that's built to descend children like me, who grew up with a father that never looked him in the eyes and a mother that was on crack rock. You know, gangs became my family, my culture, at the age of 11 going on 12 as a survival instinct. And it's like now I'm being punished because I won't tell on someone. And it's like, you know, the system is, they dropped me back out into urban culture society when I was 25 going on 26. And at the year and a half later, I shot a brother in the back of the head and executed him for robbing my family, having my family robbed and tortured. And then when I got back, they charged me with malice murder, but they never brought in the psychological issues that was going on with me. They never told my story. They never brought in mitigating factors that would allow for the judge and the jury to see that, hey, I'm hurt. I'm in pain. I'm dealing and suffering with something that is so psychologically deep that I can be changed. I can regain, you know, my sanity, and I can obtain a level of usefulness in society or in prison life that far exceeds what other people may expect from what they call an animal. But who would ever see themselves in a situation coming out of the prison environment, the worst prison in that state, coming back to an urban culture that is full of gangs and selling drugs, and one of these people comes into your home, acts like they're your friend from childhood, and then sends 13 people in there to rob, beat, torture, and stick broomsticks in the anus of your very blood family, relatives, and you welcome them in. And so in retaliation or whatever you want to call it, I blacked out and I went after this man would not leave our dwelling place and tried to take over that home. You know, it was 16 years ago today that I was arrested for this murder. And, you know, it's crazy, Sister Queen, because even at 16 years, this American Georgia system has yet to give me an opportunity to have an appeal. But we're supposed to be afforded, you know, the dual process. But when they found out that I have learned and educated myself in psychology, sociology, criminology, you know, and begin to actually learn how to grasp recovery at its deepest level of altruism and spirituality, like Carl Jung speak of, teach of, now I'm a threat to society and I have too much influence over what they call low bottom culture. Now they don't want me to even get an opportunity to go back for a motion for new trial hearing. I tell you, my sisters, that we do have a void of empathy in America. And whether we want to use it about religion, okay, the Muslim and the Christian and the Buddhist and the other cultural belief systems, whether we want to call it racist, black, white, Hispanic, you know, Arabian, you know, whether we want to call it, you know, if it's just about you got country people against the urban people, there is so much dissension. It's like they say a house divided will soon fall, you know, because everybody's judging each other. Everybody's looking how they can win their argument and their debate about being right. And it's not about being right. It's about putting on each other's shoes and walking a mile in and seeing what happened to cause these calluses and these sores. With that, I yield the mic. Thank y'all so much for letting me share.
Thank you so much, sharing that, Brother Hess. And Veronique, can you understand why your program is so, what you're doing is so well respected and admired? Because he just told this is just one incident, one sad, painful incident, one person incarcerated that went through all this. We have so many others in this 2.3 million incarcerated in the United States. And these are sad situations. These are type of situations that should be in houses like yours. And we have another call. If you will just hold on a second and find out. Do you want to state your name, please, 904?
Hello?
Yes.
This is Tahawka. I was just sitting and listening to your broadcast, and I didn't have anything to say right now. I just started listening.
Okay. Thank you so much for calling in, Tahawka. And Veronique, you want to take over where we left off? If you haven't forgotten what you were going to say, I'm sorry. But this is so important. It's so important because, as I say, what you're doing, you know, all of you, Mariam Jacobs, psychosocial therapist from the Netherlands, Dave Van Veen and Marique, Troy and Jills, and he was a formerly incarcerated. And then we have Frank DeBrun, who was on. He was a formerly incarcerated. And talking about all these things. And Franz, of course, we love him. And you're coming on. But I just I want you to finish saying what you were saying. And thank you so much again for coming on and sharing all this, because it maybe it'll touch some hearts when it comes to our government. And maybe they will try to follow suit with some of the recommendations, some of the success stories that they're hearing from over abroad.
Well, thank you for inviting me and letting me share the thinking about small-scale forms of detention. And thank you, Brother S, for sharing your story. And I would say, like, we see things in the criminal justice system as incidents, but like he was saying, it's a life narrative that starts way before often people are born. I'm thinking about like Jack Saul, who is the husband of Esther Perel, who's a relationship therapist, but he works a lot on trauma, survivors of trauma, and he found that we keep putting the guilt on the shoulders of people, whereas it's often the guilt of society. And then he has a very beautiful quote on, it's very hard to focus on self-forgiveness when you maybe shouldn't be taking on the burden of all that guilt. And maybe it should be shared by the rest of society. And maybe it's the guilt of society that sends you there. And I think that's what my whole work and life is about, that we need to stop punish people like Brother S. He was in that position where he didn't want to snitch on someone. And then we created this very rational system that then he will be punished the same way that we should have punished another person, which to me it's absurd. And my own history is that my father was in prison for something. He tried to kill my mother. I was a witness of it. And I was very young, only 6, but I knew both my parents both have had a history with also trauma. Yes. And my father he's from Algeria, and his mother, because of the French-Algerian war, so Algeria, for those that don't know, but Algeria was a colony of France, and so people were oppressed, and then they fought for independence, very much like in South Africa, and finally they got independence. But my grandmother died while giving labor during this war, and then my father was sent away to away from his family. So I think a lot of his history was actually done by countries, by the policies of countries, and a lot of the pain is in his own history. And I think that's also in the U.S., a lot of people that are in prison today are in prison because of the historical policies. of racism and discrimination, and that Martin Luther King and many others fought for to change. But we still see today in the prison system all over Europe the policies we had decades ago. And to me, that's hearing narratives like that of Brother S, it still touches like and hits me hard in the heart. And that's why I actually do the work I do, that I think we really need to become much more aware of the context and the history of why certain things happen. And a much better understanding of it.
I sent some addresses to, I believe, to you and a couple of others. If I didn't send it to you, please let me know so I can. But I sent some addresses to the law school universities in the United States, just a few of the major ones, and also the New York Times. And I was speaking with someone from over there where you are, and you know, I recommended that they make some contact in hopes of getting invited to these universities to speak on the things that you're doing, the positive things that you're doing. Not only the universities, but I would love to have legislative members invite you over. I'd love to have people in this country that are actually advocating for criminal justice reform to invite all of you over so that they can start hearing directly from you and others how you can help them in this country, help even these halfway houses to help them to be able to use your model as their model to start doing the same thing. Because it's obvious that you've had a success rate it's transparent, and that's what we need in this country, more transparency. We don't have any oversight in the prisons, which I recently learned is one of the bills that our legislative members are planning on putting out there. But there's no oversight in the prisons. So there's no one actually seeing what's going on and seeing the things that are happening in the prisons. And that's something that's very important as well. Veronique, I was going to say, I don't know if you're... if your time avails for you to stay on beyond the hour, but if not, I'd like to have you come back on again so we can, you know, take up where we left off on this discussion today.
Yeah, always welcome, and I'm always happy to connect people as well. If people want to see development or examples in Europe, everyone is welcome to send me a message, an email. I think I really believe in the power of community, and no one has the answer. We should just all like enhance the voices of people that do want that change, like you, and connect these people together.
And Brother Hess, I wanted to ask you a question. Have you ever been evaluated by anyone in the prison, any psychologist?
So it is so funny that you asked that question, dear sister, because I'm up for a motion for new trial hearing, which is supposed to happen within two years after your actual trial. I'm going on 14 years after my trial, and I just had to go pro se in order to be able to have my constitutional violations brought out inside of my brief. And that is my main concern. How is it that you all locked me up the night of the crime, took me to the county jail intake, and within 10 minutes had to tase me, subdue me, and place me in a rubber room for suicidal issues. But yet and still, you had me under medical observation for psychological malfunctions for over 3.5 weeks, giving me medications. But yet you stuck me inside of a first appearance within 24 hours. You took me to a preliminary hearing within 20 days under this type of a psychological strain, and yet and still took me to trial 2 years later, and there was nothing said to anyone in the courts from the prosecution or defense public pretender side that I had psychological issues at this time. This, man, Sister Queen, this is why I study psychology. because I want to understand what my illnesses were, and I want to get better. Because if I can get better, I can show other convicts. I can show other guys who have similar issues and personality problems and psychological, you know, diseases, that there's a way out. And so, you know, thank you for asking that question, because that's my number one ground. Why have I yet, after 16 years, why have I yet to have a psychological evaluation? I yield the floor. Thank you so much.
And I want to say, and I was going to say with you too, Veronique, post-traumatic stress syndrome. They talk about those in the military with coming out with all of this, even those incarcerated. They talk about PTSD all the time. But I know that there are many, many, many people incarcerated. And even with you, Sister Veronique, you, in talking about what you went through with your parents, you have to be suffering from some form of PTSD as well. And yet they, in the prisons, they diagnose so many people with antisocial behavior. Antisocial behavior, to me, is when you don't want to be bothering with anybody. You don't want to associate with anybody or interact with anyone. And Brother Hess, you clearly are not antisocial. That's one thing. So if they ever try to diagnose you with that, don't believe it. And that's what they do. And even with that, though, with even if it was antisocial behavior, they should not be double-selling people, putting them in a cell with other people when they're suffering from any kind of PTSD or any kind of antisocial behavior. But yet they do. They force these people into these prisons, into these cells with other people. But that's why I wanted to know, Brother Hess, if you had ever had a psychological evaluation, because if not, you need to really emphasize with them. You need to reiterate that you need to have a psychological evaluation. Whether it's going to be accurate or not, I don't know. There was a psychological evaluation that was done on a prisoner where they said the mother and father were alive together and doing well. When the father was never in the picture, the father died about, it was 2011 or 12, and the evaluation was done in 2018. So these are kind of things they throw together to make themselves look like they're doing something to justify, you know, their paycheck. But these are some of the issues. But
and also legitimize this unhealthy prison environment. If, for example, Elizabeth Allen, who is working on relational security, which is a different security paradigm, rather than static security, you can build on relational security. And she actually said that often we don't distinguish between a diagnosis and an actual the situation where anybody of us would react the same, would react in an antisocial way. Because like Brother S has explained, that there are so many absurdistic situations that they put you in the prison system. And if you have a certain diagnosis, they easily say like, oh, it's because you react this way because of you're diagnosed with something, which is really legitimizing this unhealthy system. So on the one side, you want people to understand their own behavior better, but on the other side, we also need to distinguish between the context and what the situation is and what's unhealthy from the situation and what's unhealthy from the individual perspective.
True. That makes a lot of sense, too. But, you know, that's why it's so important to have oversight in the prisons. Because sometimes the interaction between the prison, the correctional officers or the prison officials with the individuals can set them off. And it's happened so many times. I just received a video the other day and I shared it on social media where there were 3 to 5 guards walked up to this young man, and the guy, the prisoner was holding his arms out. He wasn't holding him. He was holding them out so they would see he's not going to be throwing any punches. And there were other prisoners all through the block watching, and these prison guards went up to this individual while his hands were out and started beating him up. And his hands were spread out. And so these kind of things, unnecessary disciplinary actions, unnecessary, and they do these bogus write-ups and everything else to make themselves look like they were the innocent victims when they were the perpetrators. But these are a lot of these things happen, and something needs to be done about it. And it's just sad that the incarcerated. You know, I will say too, Jan Banning, he's from the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. Jan Banning has been advocating for a prisoner in Georgia, wrongfully convicted. Her name was, Christine Boyle. And then Franz Kurz from Germany has been advocating for two wrongfully convicted prisoners in Ohio, Shane Crum and Donald Glenn. Madeline Colburn, Reverend Madeline Colburn, she's a chaplain, but she's also a prisoner advocate, and she's from Missouri, and she's been advocating for two women, Judy Pickens and also Bertha Owens, of wrongfully convicted in Missouri prisons. Beth Michaels, who is the founder of the Christian Pen Pal Connection, she's been advocating for a Christopher Dunn, who is wrongfully convicted. And if you go on the internet and type in Christopher Dunn, innocent, you will see where a judge dismissed his case and found him innocent years and years ago. And Christopher Dunn is still sitting in prison in his 40s, late 40s now.
Wow.
So in the United States, they do one thing, they say one thing and do another thing. But there are some, they just legalized marijuana in the United States, but yet mm-hmm. there's still people sitting in prison for years, sitting in prison, which they should be released because that's what they're in prison for. You mentioned mm-hmm. the three strikes law. The three strikes law, which I understood came from, started in California. I remember a prisoner when I was doing national work with the incarcerated, a prisoner was telling me that he was serving a life sentence under the three strikes law. And what he did, he tried to rob a store with a plastic gun. He got, I guess he violated his parole, probation or whatever. And he did one other thing, and he got life. And none of them were violent, but he got life sentence. But they're trying to do away now with the three strikes law. But these are all things that are happening in the United States. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people really suffering behind those prison walls that no one even knows about, especially when I think about those without any family at all and what they're going through. So again, Veronique, I thank you so much for coming on, and I look forward to having you back on again.
Really appreciate the platform and the radio show you're hosting. Thank you so much for doing that.
What you're doing is just so unique, and it's so admirable. It really is. And I know that if they take heed in this country, if they stop following some of the things that you and the others have been doing throughout, maybe we'll start seeing some positive things happening in the United States. But one of the things they have to do, and I understand no other country in the world sentences beyond 25 years maximum, unless it's a terrorist, unless it's serial killers, or unless it's mass shootings. But I understand that the maximum sentencing is 25 years. In the United States, it's life without parole, and the death penalty, which goes to show you the attitudes, the mindset of lawmakers in the United States. It's that, as one of them, I think it was Franz said one time, there's a lot of racism in the United States. There's a lot of vengeance, a lot of retaliation, a lot of corruption, a lot of deception. These are the things that we have in this country. And that's why it's going to take a long time to get to the point where we have normal sentences and normal treatment and conditions as you do over in your countries. So I thank you so much for coming on. And if you will, give the audience again your contact information, anything that you can give them that where they can get in contact with you if they want to. And also, I was going to ask, have you written any books?
Not yet. I'm too chaotic of a thinker, but I'm working on a theory, a different theory of justice, where we include the historical injustice and take that into account in our criminal justice system, and not only look at the individual, but look at the context. So
yes.
I am trying to frame that. But I think amazing work has been done by Mass Design Group, for example, who are linking justice to architecture, and that's from the U.S. So I get a lot of my inspiration from the U.S. and also, like Brother S, from philosophers. So, yeah.
You know, people...
reach me, they can go to the reskilled.org website. My contact information is there. And please send me a message and if you're interested.
Okay, that's www.rescaled, R-E-S-C-A-L-E-D.org, rescaled.org. And if you want to just check out their mission and their vision, it's www.rescaled.org/mission-vision. You're going to be impressed with this program and this work that they're doing. So, Veronique, we will be talking soon. I will get the dates and times that you can come back on again, and I'll set it up and send out the invitation again.
Hope to speak to you again, and also to you, Brother S.
And Brother Hess, I want to thank you for sharing your story with us too. I didn't know that as well, and it's truly a sad story, and too much of it goes on in this country, and it needs to stop. It really does. So
I appreciate it, but please don't feel bad for me. You know what I mean? I feel like, you know what I'm saying, it takes people like me to go through what we must go through in order to be able to articulate it, you know what I'm saying, in a fashion to where those who normally don't understand or comprehend can actually be able to grasp it, you know what I'm saying, from a standpoint that is unique. So I thank y'all so much for letting me be on with this system. God bless.
You would be better in to go into the colleges, the universities, and the community colleges and talk to these young people that probably are feeling the same way you felt back then and are going through a lot of the same thing. But I think that when people have been incarcerated for as long as you have and others have, that the best place to put them is on the outside where they can stop these young people from making the same mistakes. And this is how our government leaders need to think instead of just keeping them in the prisons and throwing away the key. But again, I want to thank you both for being on. Audience, we are going to be ending this episode now, and we will have Veronique Aicha coming back on with us. And Brother Hess, I'd like to have you come on sometime and tell your story to the world, because these stories need to be told. Real quickly, I wanted to mention, too, there have been a couple of incarcerated individuals who were wrongfully convicted. One was in Texas. His name was Ajim, and he's originally from Nigeria. He was a college student. He got stopped by the police and set up in Texas years ago. He served 22 years on a wrongful conviction. Before he could tell his story, they deported him back to Nigeria. He's been wanting to get his story out, so he's finally, and I talked to him about it, he's finally writing a book, and the book is almost finished now. I had Fran de Brown on yesterday, and from the Netherlands, and he was talking about how he was wrongfully convicted, and he was talking about the injustice that he went through, and then also put in a place where he couldn't even understand the people in the dorm that he was in. They were all speaking different languages, and this was in Italy. So he ended up learning how to speak English. He already knew, but he learned how to speak Italian. He learned how to speak German, and he learned how to speak Spanish all through the setting that he was in. He had no choice but to learn. But there are so many others who have been wrongfully convicted and either deported, or they're still in prison, or they were released and never got a chance to tell their story. So this is why I'm glad, Brother Hess, you were able to share that with us. And one of these days, I'd love to have you come on and talk about your situation as well. In the meantime, audience, we are now going to close this episode, and we look forward to our guests coming back on again. And I want everyone to have a blessed day. Thank you again, Veronique, and thank you, Brother Hess.
Thank you.
God bless.